This is The Human and the Machine, brought to you by Editorial Intelligence.
Welcome to The Human and Machine, the podcast where we explore the limits of humans, machines, and the shifting boundaries between them. I'm Julia Hobsbawm. My co-presenter, as usual, is Charles Arthur, the author most recently of Hacks That Shocked the Business World, and formerly The Guardian technology editor. Welcome, Charles. Why is it so noisy where we are?
That's because we're at the COGEX Festival of AI in King's Cross in London, and a location that's all been built up. It's all luxury flats and brand new offices, and it would have been underwater, I think, a few years ago. But now is festooned and filled with people from all sorts of startups, and you can't sort of move without someone telling you about machine learning and so on.
We have one single guest with us today. We're extremely lucky to have him. He's just come off stage. He is Lord Rees, Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal. He's been speaking at COGEX. He is, of course, the most distinguished scientist we have in Britain, and he has just written a book called On the Future, Perspectives and Prospects for Humanity. Welcome, Martin.
Thank you, Julie. Great to be here.
How has it been for you so far in this hub of emerging technology?
Well, very stimulating. I haven't found my way around fully because the meetings take place in different places. We were supposed to be in some open-air theatre, but because of the bad weather, we were in some sort of tunnel instead. But it worked quite well.
Well, that's right up your street, isn't it? The resilience of the human being,
right,
in the face,
yes,
of enormous technological challenges.
So, Martin, give people an idea about what your book is tackling. What are the? Are you generally an optimist? Are you generally a pessimist? And what is the role of the machine in all of this in deciding whether actually we come out of the end in a good way or a bad way?
Well, the book has the rather pretentious title of On the Future, but what I really try to do is to explore what's going to happen over the next 50 years or so. And there are two kinds of concerns. One is the effect we are having collectively on the planet through change of the climate, periling biodiversity, etc. That's one concern. And the second is that some technologies like AI and bio are running away so fast that we may not be able to properly cope with them. And they, of course, have the possibility of allowing individuals or small groups to be far more greatly empowered. And therefore, that's a challenge to governance. So I think the short answer to your question is I'm a scientific optimist, but a political pessimist, because I think it's going to be hard for us to cope with these new techniques.
You do say something very interesting in your book about how the balance of effort in technology needs redirection. What does that mean?
Well, I think obviously we are concerned about the downsides of technology, the huge runaway growth in weapons, more sophisticated nuclear weapons, etc., and also the misdirection of talent. Too many people being millisecond traders or other socially useless functions, and not enough people doing the kind of things where this could be hugely beneficial to the world. And I do in my book really question to what extent we can say we are progressing. Of course, we know that we are progressing collectively in terms of life expectancy, literacy rates, health, etc., and that's true globally. And so we can be cheerful about that. But I think ethically, it's hard to discern progress. Let me give an explanation of this. If we go back to the Middle Ages, the life for everyone was pretty miserable. The cathedral builders had a miserable lifestyle. But the gap between the way things were and the way they could be wasn't great, because they couldn't have done much to improve their lot. Whereas now, there's a huge gap between the way things are and the way they could be. To give one simple example, which I quote, the wealth of the 2,000 richest people in the world could double the income of the bottom billion. And it's a real ethical indictment that we are so far from having a fair and equal society.
Is that partly, do you think, that the scale of technology has allowed the accumulation of wealth even faster than before?
Well, indeed, it does. And, of course, we've seen the growth of huge international conglomerates, which are not only escaping tax, but also are having a huge impact on our lifestyles.
This is very much the sort of argument that Thomas Piketty makes, isn't it? It's the sort of the argument he makes in Capital, which is that capital becomes, well, indeed Karl Marx, that capital becomes the way to gain more wealth, that it's not really done through the fruits of labour, it's much more done through the fruits of owning capital.
Yes.
But I suppose the problem then becomes that how do you make yourselves progress? You're talking about what's the point in having a millisecond trader doing these things. Indeed, what's the point in people doing Bitcoin and so on? Would be another argument when we could be better directed. And I guess that all comes down to a fundamental question of, well, how do we order the world? How do we order what we do?
That's right. Of course, going back to Piketty, I think it's fair to say that most of the richest people now have not inherited capital. They have actually changed the world. I mean, the great founders of the Silicon Valley companies and their Chinese counterparts, they've actually changed the world. They're not people who are living on capital. So his analysis doesn't really apply to them. But I think that there is a worry about how the wealth is deployed. And, of course, if we think about the issues which confront us because of the development of machines and the redeployment of the labour market that's going to happen, I think it's going to be crucially important to ensure that the owners of the robots are heavily taxed and the money is used to create huge numbers of dignified, secure jobs for people who will care for young and old, and do the kind of jobs where the human element is crucial. We want to be looked after by a real person when we're old. We want kids to be read to by real people who can emotionally engage, not by a machine. And there's a huge demand, which is now unmet in our societies, for these sorts of jobs. And those people who now work in an Amazon warehouse or in a call center, which is pretty inhuman work, would be far more satisfied if they could be given work as a carer. And so we've got to ensure that the money is there, and this is going to require massive redistribution of wealth.
Presumably, though, the science gives us cause for optimism, because no amount of machine learning is likely, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that no amount of machine learning is going to adequately replicate the enormous complexity and beauty of the human anytime soon.
Well, of course, machines can surpass humans by a large margin in many contexts, can't they? For 40 years, they've been able to do arithmetic better than us, and now they can do many other things better than us. But I still think that we are human beings, and our relation to other human beings is something which can't be adequately replaced by our relation to robots, despite certain well-known movies on this subject.
But do you think the politics of robotics and AI means that, in addition to the, if you like, the wealth inequality that you've talked about, that there's a kind of ideological divide between those of us who really don't believe that a machine is fundamentally going to be better than a human and people who really do?
Well, of course, there's many people who are experts in robotics who accept that for a long time we'll have to worry less about artificial intelligence than about real stupidity. But on the other hand, there are people of whom the exemplar is Ray Kurzweil, who wrote a book called The Age of Spiritual Machines. And his idea was that the machines would eventually take over, and indeed we would merge with them. In old-fashioned spiritualist parlance, we go over to the other side and we would become part of some machine or common consciousness. So these are ideas familiar from science fiction, and people like him actually take these seriously as a future. I'm not sure that this is really going to happen, but it's a possible option. But I think we are going to have to cope with changes which are very, very fast, and not only machines, but also genetics. And we are going to have to regulate the use of genetic modification and the use of cyborg brain enhancements if we want to avoid a new fundamental kind of inequality, and if we want to avoid all kinds of ethical concerns. But in my book, I have another chapter where I discuss space. And the line I take there is that there will be a few people at the end of a century, maybe living on Mars. I think they should be privately funded. There's no practical case for sending them. They'll be adventurers. But those guys out there, we'll have every incentive to use all the techniques of genetic modification and cyborg to adapt to a hostile environment. And they will be away from the regulators. So they will use all these techniques, and good luck to them. And we should cheer them on, because they will perhaps be the instigators of some sort of post-human species. But I think on Earth, let's hope that we can control the use of these techniques and keep humans as they are. But I think there is a worry, because I think there are going to be changes which are much faster than those from Darwinian selection. Because to give an example, human brains haven't changed very much since our ancestors roamed the African savannas. And this therefore means that when we read the classical literature written 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, we have an affinity and a resonance with those ancient artists and their products, because their brains and their emotions were like ours. But I think it's quite on the cards that the entities a few centuries from now may have no emotional resonance with us, because there will be a change far faster than has occurred through natural evolution.
To tie a few things together then, you said at the beginning you're a scientific optimist, a political pessimist. In your talk today, you said that you think we're going through a sort of a pinch point in our history, in our sort of evolution, that there's a period of about a century, really from, I suppose, from the invention of nuclear weapons to some future time later this century, where basically we have to get through that, and if we don't, then we're really cooked.
Yes, well, indeed. I mean, I emphasize in my book that the Earth has existed for 45 million centuries, and we've taken 4 billion years to evolve from primordial life. But this century is the first when one species, the human species, has the capacity to affect the planet's future.
I mean, we had the chance, and nearly took it, back in the 60s and, you know, from 1945 onwards, to really, really wreck the planet.
Well,
and so far have not done so.
Yes.
But now we're also doing it in a slower way, the slow cooker way, with global heating. And what I suppose I wanted to ask, really, tying together what you were just talking about with genetic modification, is might we see a way out where actually we go for CRISPR and we do some genetic modification, where we're able to survive in hotter climates, when we're actually able to survive in greater extremes or with less oxygen? Might that be a way out of this, or is that just not feasible?
Well, that's a possible way, but I think issues like feeding the world and climate change can be dealt with conventionally. It just needs a redeployment of technological effort. So I think we can do that. But I think there is this important issue that we have been under threat. When people know I'm an astronomer, they think I worry about asteroid impacts and things like that. I don't, because it's a quantifiable risk, but a small one, as you know. And the big risks that we should worry about are those engendered by humans. And indeed, in our lifetime, much the biggest was indeed the threat of a nuclear exchange during the Cold War, when there were 60 or 70,000 nuclear weapons on each side. And if we listen to what the politicians said afterwards, we were really lucky. McNamara and Kennedy both said there was a chance of 1 in 3 or so at the time of the Cuba crisis of a catastrophe, which would have destroyed the entire fabric of North Europe and North America. And of course, there have been other sort of false alarms that could have gone badly. So we've been lucky. There are, of course, nuclear weapons in the hands of about 10 countries now, but not quite so many. So although there's a greater risk of some nuclear weapons going off, there's less risk of a real global catastrophe, nuclear winter and all that. But of course, this risk may be just in abeyance, and maybe a new standoff between new superpowers later this century will be handled less well or less luckily. So the nuclear threat was the first, and that's 20th century technology being applied. But of course, as you say, we now have 21st century technologies of biotech and cybertech, which of course have similar downsides. And of course, downsides of a new kind, because whereas nuclear weapons require large special purpose facilities, and it's possible to monitor and verify compliance with treaties, etc., these new technologies, like bio and cyber, require widely dispersed and small-scale dual-use facilities, which are very hard to monitor, and they give a small group or even a single individual the capacity to cause massive disruption, holding down the electricity grid of a large area of a continent, or causing an artificial pandemic and things like that. And as I say in my book, the global village will have its village idiots, and they now have a global range. And I think to cope with this is going to be a really big challenge to governance, because we have to reconcile three things we want to preserve. One is freedom, the other is security, and the other is privacy. And I think we can't have all three. There's a tension between those. I think privacy is the first one that's going to give, but we're going to have big problems between liberty and security.
Are they sort of a choose two sort of thing? You know, it's a bit like good, fast, cheap, choose two. Freedom, security, privacy, choose two. Do you think it's like that? Is the end state that if you actually want to control global heating, then you have to give up some of the freedom and you go for a China-style government everywhere?
Well, I think we may not even be able to keep two. And incidentally, one of the things that AI could do is allow the Chinese to have a efficient planned economy of a kind that Marx could only dream of, because they have the data and the processing power to actually arrange all this. So that's a change. But I think we do have to worry about this. And of course, you mentioned earlier changing human beings to make them more sort of emollient. And that reminds me, there's a book by Skinner, the behaviorist, which was called Beyond Freedom and Dignity. And this was written in about the 60s, I think. And he did speculate that perhaps in order to survive, we would need to sort of tone down the range of human characteristics, because otherwise there would be the risk, because we can less tolerate extremism now than we could in the past, because it can cascade globally, empowered by these new technologies.
There is, isn't there, though, a very frightening disconnect between the neurological capacity of the human brain with its meager 10 billion neurons and those of supercomputing, and therefore the social effects on a society. Noah Yuval Harari has written about this, that we are immature and fractious as people, because our human brains are coping with really too much progress. And you're alluding to that yourself.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think computers have the advantage of speed. But this, incidentally, doesn't help them very much if we wanted to understand human beings and common sense, because they learn very fast by looking at millions of pages of multilingual documents, or playing many games per second of chess against themselves and all that. Whereas learning by watching human beings isn't so easy. It's like us watching trees grow. It's terribly slow, and they won't be able to accumulate the volume of data to learn in the way they learn about human behavior and common sense.
But
that's,
I also meant away from the sort of scaled, catastrophic scenarios that, yes, you're gaming, it seems to me, in your work, is the granular behavioral reality of humans in this incredibly, yes, super fast scaled era, which is, yes, a lot of social science is showing that we humans are really struggling to keep up with a society that is now completely dominated by at scale, at speed technology.
I think so. I don't think we're aware of that always in our everyday life. And I think we mustn't be too modest about our comparison with machines, because let's think of the machine which beat the world champion at the game of Go and could beat any human at chess. The human champion has a brain which uses about 30 watts, about like a light bulb, and could do many other things apart from play a game. Whereas the machine that defeated these game players used many hundreds of kilowatts and was entirely inflexible. It couldn't play any other game or do anything else. So the flexibility and range of the human brain is still something that machines are very far from matching.
But the evidence seems to be that the human being is socially tiring of the complexity of the 35,000 decisions that is our cognitive limit a day, and the range of technological opportunities and challenges we're presented with. Do you not worry that, as I say, aside from the mega risks, that there are more quotidian risks that we did lead, as you said, several centuries ago, remarkably simpler lives?
I think there may be a a consumer reaction against this, because it's true, it's possible to have an automatic home, you know, with lots of gadgets in it, and something which tells you when your tube of toothpaste is running out. But I don't need a machine to tell me that. I can see myself. And so there are lots of things which a machine could do. But frankly, people are quite happy to do them themselves. I think there may be a reaction against this. And I also think that fully driverless cars on ordinary roads are much further in the future than the optimists think. I mean, I think we could have a driverless car in a special lane on a motorway, in a special environment. But I'm not sure we'll ever really have a driverless car that will catch on, which allows us to relax in the back seat as though we had a real chauffeur. That may never happen. So I think there may be a reaction against the this burst in technology. And more generally, if we think about how fast these technologies advance, there's been a huge advance, obviously, in AI and, of course, in the technology embedded in a smartphone, which has pervaded the whole world far quicker than any other technology has. But it may level off, this sigmoid curve where you get rapid growth and the leveling off, just like other things. I mean, 50 years ago, we had the Apollo moon landing. Nothing has matched that in space. 50 years ago, we had the first flights of the jumbo jet. Again, we're still flying in jumbo jets. So many technologies don't change very fast, and it could be that this amazing burst, which has led to AI and the smartphone, an amazing combination of technologies, may, in retrospect, look exceptional, and so, we may stabilise.
So do you think then that we might see a sort of a rejection of technology as part, perhaps, of trying to hit a target of reducing carbon emissions that people would... there are some people who say, I'm not going to use my smartphone, I'm going to have this clunky old chocolate bar Nokia phone and use that. Do you see that as part of a social movement that might happen towards solving the bigger problem that
I think it may happen, because I think it's always useful to look at what rich people choose to do when they have the choice. And one thing they like to do is they like to have real people to care for them and service them. They don't want a machine to do it. Also, they like to live in a place with a big garden and estate or something and in touch with nature. And so what people really want, as exemplified by what those people have, is very far from the kind of world where everything is done by machines. And so I think we can learn lessons from that.
And do you have examples? I mean, I suppose the nuclear example of where the scientific optimism, political pessimism actually works out, that, you know, that was solved in the Second World War. To some extent, it's been solved sort of almost accidentally by the standoffs that we've seen since then as more and more countries have got nuclear weapons. Do you see the same sort of thing happening with global heating? Because I wonder whether, if it was framed as a war, if we were told aliens are heating up the planet, then you could imagine that everyone would get mobilized and that we'd have sort of, you know, don't turn on that light sort of messages all the time.
That
we need somehow to have that thinking that we're almost under attack. To feel that's the way it is.
We do, and that's why I think we should welcome these campaigns, especially by young people. But I think the problem of climate change is that the worst effects are several decades in the future and probably in distant parts of the world. And the hard thing is to persuade individuals and politicians to take actions which may have negative consequences here and now, but are essential if you want to avoid a big disaster far away and in the future. And here again, I think public opinion is very, very important, because politicians obviously have an urgent agenda, but they do respond to their inbox, they respond to what's in the press. And I think that means that politicians will respond, will do the right thing, if they know the they won't lose votes thereby. And to give an example, recently, I doubt that Mr. Gove would have cared at all about cutting down on the reusable drinking straws and things of that kind, had it not been for the Blue Planet programmes with David Attenborough, showing the iconic image of the albatross returning to its nest and coughing up plastic and not the longed-for food for its young in the nest. And that's an example which is an iconic image, rather like the polar bear and the melting ice flow. And I think that must have given Mr. Gove confidence that enough people were now aware of the plastic in the ocean problems they weren't in the past, and therefore he would not lose votes by trying to do something about it.
It's also zeitgeist, though, isn't it? Mr. Gove, you're referring to, is Britain's Environment Secretary, and there's a moment suddenly where an awareness, probably stimulated in part by the David Attenborough BBC programme, amongst other factors, made us extremely sensitive. I wonder what you think the largely young generation of tech evangelists who have been cutting about this place in King's Cross for the last couple of days, what are you picking up they feel and think about the state of the world? Do they think technology is the answer?
Well, I think they are sort of altruistic, and of course they are a style of person which is more concerned with experience than possessions, you know, and which is also a good thing. But if we think of the global heating problem and all that, I think the one win-win way to solve it is to accelerate research and development into all forms of clean energy and energy storage methods, you know, better batteries, etc., so that these techniques become more efficient and, more importantly, become cheap. Because what is going to happen otherwise is that countries like India, where they now depend on smoky stoves burning wood and dung in their homes, they're going to build coal-fired power stations because they want more power, they want a grid. And if they could afford just as easily to leapfrog directly to clean energy, they would do so. So I think if we can accelerate the development of cheap, clean energy for the world, that would be the best way to actually move towards a low-carbon future, because India and other countries would choose to leapfrog directly, just like they leapfrog to mobile phones and never had landlines. They would never go through a stage where they depend on burning fossil fuels in their power stations.
And do you believe we have the right global institutions at the moment working together? I mean, both the political institutions and indeed the scientific ones. I mean, do we need a new era of Royal Society? You were the president of the Royal Society. I mean, where are the innovative ideas and change-making actions happening globally in your... Are you optimistic or pessimistic about those?
Well, of course, we do have international bodies like the International Atomic Energy Agency, the World Health Organization, etc. And indeed, we may need a few more like that.
Well, that was my question, really.
There's a discussion which Charles probably knows more about than I do about regulating the internet. And that's something where you need an international organization, given especially that the companies are international conglomerates already, and to provide a balancing power to them needs international coordination. So I think in that area, and maybe in food production and monitoring whether countries are meeting their targets for cutting CO2, we probably need some other organisation in the same way.
I would add to the pot the global workplace and how it's being affected by AI. I'm not sure that the International Labour Organization or the World Bank are the only places
that should be talking about that.
Martin, I can't help noticing that you're wearing a very old tech item on your right wrist. You're wearing a very beautiful watch.
Yes, yes.
Surely new technology has done away with the need. Why do you carry a timepiece about you?
Well, I find it much more convenient than having to look at my phone to see the time.
But it's interesting, isn't it, how time has remained a constant for all of our modernity. We still measure it and monitor it and are somehow governed, aren't we, by time?
Well, we're even more obsessed by it than we were.
An expert of the cosmos, tell us about that. Why are we so transfixed by time and the passing of time?
Well, because we are mortal. We've got to make use of the limited number of years available to us. And as I get older, I become more aware of this. And I do care about time. And indeed, I've got an old and very cheap watch. Incidentally, I have no idea why people ever buy expensive watches, because the cheap one is very good. But I think awareness of time is important. But, of course, going back to what we were talking about for global heating, I think the worry is that most people, either personally or in economic decisions, apply a discount rate which gives no value to what happens more than 50 years ahead. And indeed, I discuss in my book one of the problems of climate policy, because even those who accept the science differ in their proposed remedies and the urgency depending on economics and ethics. And I quote in particular Bjorn Lomborg, who's a bogeyman among some environmentalists, slightly unfairly because he doesn't contest the science, but he's got this group of economists, and they downplay the importance of dealing with climate change compared to other ways of helping the world's poor because they apply a 5% discount rate and therefore give no weight in their calculations to what happens after 2050.
In effect, they assume that inflation will be 5% forever, don't they? So things in the future will not be as expensive as they are now.
Well, that's right. They assume there will be real economic growth, which, of course, there may not be because the discount rate is endogenous, and if things get really bad, we need a negative discount rate. But I think most people feel we ought to care about the life's chances of people born today who'll be alive in the 22nd century. So this is, I think, a reason where we do need to have longer-term thinking. And of course, as an astronomer, I'm used to thinking very long terms. And incidentally, one effect that does have is that, as an astronomer, I'm aware not only of the long-term past, the 4 billion years of Darwinian evolution that's led to us, but also that we aren't the culmination, that the time lying ahead is probably even longer. So we are probably not even the halfway stage in the emergence of complexity in the cosmos. But the difference is that this century is special, not only for the reasons we've already discussed, but special because it's the time when Darwinian selection is replaced by what you might call a secular intelligent design. We can design machines and redesign human beings, and so post-human evolution will go ahead, probably faster away from the Earth than here on the Earth. But this century is special for that reason. But the far future is something which astronomers are probably more aware of than most people.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Can I make one point, really?
Please,
about
do.
Timescales? I was talking just last week to a very large audience, 1,200 people in York Minster. Wonderful occasion. And that made me think about the contrast between the life of those who built that marvellous edifice, which wasn't finished in their lifetime, and our lives today. And it at first seems paradoxical that the people at that time were prepared to lay down bricks on a cathedral that wouldn't be finished in their lifetime, whereas now we find it hard to plan even 30 years ahead, even though we've got these huge horizons I've just mentioned, stretching billions of years into the future. But I think the reason it's not a paradox is that the medieval cathedral builders may have thought there might be an apocalypse in 1,000 years, but they thought that the lives of their children and their grandchildren would be roughly like theirs. They didn't expect big changes from one generation to the next, whereas now we have no confidence at all in the lifestyles of people 50 years from now. So, ironically, although our cosmic horizons have extended, our social planning horizons are shorter. And this, of course, is at least a slight excuse for not taking seriously these very long-term plans.
Thank you so much. You're about the only person I can think of that could talk about catastrophe and bring a smile to one's face as you describe it. Martin Rees, Lord Rees, thank you so much for joining us. Your wonderful book on the future prospects for humanity is published by Princeton and is highly readable, highly accessible. You've been listening to The Human and Machine with me, Julia Hobsbawm, and Charles Arthur. And we were joined today by Martin Rees, Lord Rees. It's an editorial intelligence production carried out live here at COGX. Our producer with us is Lucy Ditchmond, and our editor is George McDonough. Thank you, Martin. Next time we'll give you a watch with 1,000 years on it.